You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, December 30th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Yes, our best of 2015 week continues as we are enjoying or being with our family on this vacation break. Michael's at a yoga retreat, probably. Either that or touring wine country. And I don't know if they would let him in, in California. What's that place? Can't remember.
Napa Valley.
Why would you let me there?
I don't know. Maybe they would.
My rage disorder?
Yeah.
I'm not a wine yoga.
Wine yoga retreat.
Retreat.
It's where they transcendentally meditate.
What happens is
along with a bunch of sommeliers.
You know those that's correct. And you know those camel packs that bikers, long distance bikers would of course you're not into fitness and stuff. But they basically it looks really weird. It's like this backpack with a water.
You know what I'm talking about.
We do hot yoga and we have a camel pack, except it's filled with Malbec.
You know, that's it's funny you say that, because there is literally, I am sure, I have just seen an in law who drinks the wine from the sippy cup. I kid you not. I'm not kidding.
Take it boxed to a whole new level, dude.
It's box wine. But then it's more convenient to go around in one of those big sippy things. I'm not kidding. Like one of those like hard hats with the tubes. Nevertheless, ladies and gentlemen, we have for you a best of 2015. As regular listeners would know, twice a year I go to a mass torts conference. My co-host on the other show I do, Ring of Fire Radio, is a prominent trial lawyer in the country. And it is a conference of trial lawyers. And it is, I'm fascinated by this stuff. It's also quite disturbing when you hear about the corporate malfeasance that takes place every day. And you begin to realize that in an era where regulations are rolled back, where there is a revolving door, where regulatory agencies, many times, far too often, either are defunded by a right-wing Congress, are limited in their statutory authority by a Republican-dominated Congress, or just in, long-time tradition, or are in some ways corrupted by the revolving door, you begin to realize that trial lawyers, and our society loves to disparage them, and you begin to understand why. All the money behind big tobacco, all the money behind big oil, all the money behind pharmaceuticals seeks to disparage them and to block people's access to the courts when you hear the type of cases they have. So I was at the Las Vegas conference of the mass torts and spoke to three different attorneys on three different cases. One was a case involving DuPont and the chemical C8. Which is a chemical used in the making of that nonstick surface on your pan. It's not in the that nonstick surface on your pan, but it is a chemical used in the production of it. And then an interview with an attorney who was beginning to look at the VW cases, where they basically jerry-rigged their cars in such a way to escape detection of their emissions when they were tested for emissions. And then the story of a company that was it's called Factor 8, and they were selling tainted blood to hemophiliacs, and they knew they were selling this. I mean, it is, I think it's very hard for us as non-sociopaths to understand just how bad some corporations can be. And perhaps, you know, and there's been a lot of, you know, discussion about this around like Enron and the Milgram tests, I think it was. And, you know, what happens in a corporation when people are at sort of arm's length to these decisions, they can make some very, very bad decisions, mean decisions. So listen to these attorneys. I think you'll enjoy it. And then for members, I'll be talking to Paul Starr, who this is from the Deep Archive, back in the Majority Report. I think it was back in 2005, if I'm not mistaken. 2004, I believe. Maybe it was July of 2004. Paul Starr had written a book about the history of communications. And this, of course, is a 12-year-old interview, but it was about the way, basically, the FCC functioned, about how, if I remember correctly, this is literally from memory, that it was about how radio stations and broadcast license got doled out, and how these political decisions sort of shaped the future of our communications in this country. Fascinating stuff, if I remember correctly. Matt has picked all this stuff, so, you know, that is, I'm contractually obligated to sign off on whatever he picks. That's just, I'm not a great negotiator. Probably a mistake. So, I trust Matt, and you should too. And so enjoy this best of, both for members and you freebeers. And tomorrow we've got a replaying an interview that I think more than any other story of the year has stuck with me. We will play that tomorrow. And then, of course, Friday, we have a casual Friday mix. So, get ready for a New Year's. It's happening tomorrow, if I remember correctly. All right, folks. Enjoy this best of 2015. Joining me now to talk about a case that has been, that got a lot of attention. We spoke about it quite a bit, frankly, on the show only a couple of weeks ago. It's Tim Maloney. He's an attorney from Maloney and Campolo in San Antonio. The Volkswagen case. Sure. Give people the sort of the, what do they call it, the fact set?
We'll give you the Reader's Digest version of where we're at on the case. Most people have probably heard some things about the, what's going on. And quickly, what it is that Volkswagen made a decision that instead of going with hybrid or electric technology, they were going to go with clean diesel. And it sounds oxymoronic to say clean diesel, and the truth is, it is oxymoronic. Volkswagen decided that they were going to bring these cars over, and the way to beat the EPA testing was to install something called a defeat device. And defeat device is a fancy name for cheating. That's all it was. The way it is, like a lot of our regulatory agencies that we have here, is that it's self-reporting, and that the EPA doesn't do the testing, which I think a lot of people are surprised about. The manufacturers actually do the test that is set up by the EPA, and then they say, you know what? We passed with flying colors. Here's our data.
Now, is it my understanding is, I mean, and maybe this is different from state to state, my understanding that it may be, when I go to get my car inspected in New York State,
right,
the guy walks around the car, he looks, headlights work, right. I don't have a cracked taillight, and then he either plugs it in, I guess, into the computer, and then maybe puts something in the tailpipe
right.
to measure the emissions.
Right.
Now, my understanding is that this the device that right. they were using was basically their computer was had the ability to sense,
yep.
okay, you're being tested,
yep.
you're being probed at the moment, so
No one said
down.
These guys weren't stupid.
I mean, but is that yeah. basically what they did? They yeah. designed
right.
a piece of software to say, like, hey, there's a test going on.
Yep.
So what was it? Every time somebody plugged into the computer? Or
the way it works is the dynamometer in which they go ahead and test these cars, they do it by three different things. One, they do it by the positioning of the front wheels, meaning that the wheels stay straight for a period of time, and also the idle, and a few other criteria. When the car is being tested, the software, being really smart software, detects that it is going into what's called EPA mode, and it literally then would shut down power, shut down the exhaust, shut down the torque, and pass the EPA inspection. So every time you would be tested in California or in New York, it would actually detect that a EPA testing was being done or a state inspection was being done and could literally switch over to that mode. The minute it went back on the road in real-world driving conditions, it switched back to factory mode.
And in factory mode apparently gave the car more power. That's basically what it came down to, right?
Well, if you know a little bit about diesel motors, why diesels are so great and fun to drive, it's not really the horsepower. It's the torque.
I'm not even sure. I know so little about that. Yeah. Like, I'm not even sure I know what that means.
Torque is pulling power.
Okay.
Torque is when you go off the line and you get real fast, 0 to 60 times. Horsepower,
so it's the rate of increase.
Right. Horsepower okay. has nothing to really do with that. It's torque. And so that's what makes these cars so much fun to drive. And if you drive one, they're a blast to drive. They really are. And so that is what the real-world driving experience would sold these cars. That people were going, wow, I'm driving the cleanest car on the road. I'm getting, you know, 50, 60 miles a gallon.
Right.
And the car drives like a bat out of hell. I mean, who wouldn't want one?
All right. Well, let me play devil's advocate. 2 out of 3 ain't bad.
Except that third one's a real problem.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I should say, and let's get into sort of the, I want to talk about the theory under which
sure.
you pursue a case like this.
Right.
And then also, I guess we can, I should tell the audience that before we went on, you asked me how badly can I speak of this company?
Because I can't speak badly enough.
Well, and I said, yeah, go to town. I mean,
I'm not kidding you. I think you and I were chatting earlier. This doesn't rise to the level of corporate malfeasance, or we made a boo-boo,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, we had a bad part and we're going to try to fudge it and get through with it. This was a conscious decision by the guys in Wolfsburg, Germany, to try to sell cars that were illegal worldwide. They knew about it, they designed it, and they made a conscious decision at the board level to say, go for it. And that, to me, that's not a tort, that's not a lawsuit. Somebody's ass needs to be in jail. And hopefully that's what's going to happen. This doesn't, the legal civil part will settle out some point in time. There'll be a come to reckoning. That's not good enough, in my opinion. There are people over there who put 500,000 cars over a period of time starting in 2009 that are pumping out 40 times, not just 40%. We're talking an exponential number of 40 times the pollutants. And being an LA guy, New York guy, I'm down from, you know, San Antonio and Houston.
That's 4,000%.
Exactly right. That's what they were doing. So every time they went in, Sam goes in to buy himself a clean car. Because you know what? Sam likes trees.
Right.
He wants to do the right thing. He wants to do the right environment. And that salesman's looking at you and says, Sam, I am so proud of what you're doing. I'm so proud that you're taking care of the environment. and you're going to drive this car, and every day you're going to feel good about yourself. You go home, and you're going, man, I got a cute, peppy car. And you wake up one morning, and you find out you're the worst polluter on the road.
Mm.
And you still have the damn car in your driveway. And tomorrow morning when you wake up and you hit your little clicker to get in that car, you're going, damn, how many trees am I killing today? How many kids are going to be breathing this stuff when I drop off in the school?
Right. And so, okay, so let's start with the, let me just ask about the criminal element, and then we'll get to
sure.
the civil, because, I mean, you're going to be involved in trying to get some form of, recover some damages, and
yep.
I want to talk about what the theory
sure.
damages are.
Sure.
But, I mean, and I imagine you come across, I mean, almost every lawyer I speak to here who gets involved in mm-hmm. this has, I can ask them, like, what is the most disturbing case you've had or, you know, where they go in and they actually start to see the documents that mm-hmm. would create
yep.
the sort of look into the black box where the output is, we're going to put out all these cars mm-hmm. that are going to be designed
right.
to break the law
right.
and to hide it. I mean, it's
yep.
like, what
yep.
is the thought process here? Like, what at what point did these board of directors or did this CEO say, like, oh, damn, we have a problem. We thought we could develop this,
right.
and we can't, and we got all these cars. But what we can develop is a way to make it look like we developed these
sure.
things. I mean, is that how it happens?
Yeah, pretty much. And what happened was this. 2006, 2007, Volkswagen made a conscious decision that they were going to be the world's largest car company. And they gave themselves a 10-year period that they were going to overtake Toyota. And that was the mentality that was instilled from the guy turning bolts on the floor down to the boardroom. That the mindset was, we will sell more cars than anybody on the planet Earth. We will be number one. And what's going to set us unique? What product do we have that's going to be different? And that's where the whole clean diesel technology came in.
I have to tell you, I exercise a tremendous amount of restraint by not, as you were describing, the motivations of yeah. VW of hitting... on my soundboard, I have Deutschland, Deutschland. So I should just let you know.
The 2008, 2009, and this is the crucial time period, it really is. We're going to find out that the engineers went to them and said, we can't do this. I mean, we have to go to what's called the SCR system. Basically, it's called the urea system that Mercedes has, BMW has. And it's kind of a pain to have this system because it's about a gallon container of fluid that's in your car that has to be filled up. It's called AdBlue about twice a year. It takes up space. And in the smaller cars, it takes up so much space you wouldn't even have a spare tire. I mean, it's a
mm-hmm.
it's an awkward system, but it works. It actually does clean up the emissions. Well, in the smaller cars, the Generation 1 cars, these are the Golfs and the Jettas, there physically wasn't room to put this system in. But they had committed so much to clean diesel, they said, oh, hell, we've got to come up with something. And that something was, these defeat devices aren't new. They've been around for a long time, but not this sophisticated. They were on, like, big trucks, Caterpillars, those sort of things. Well, VW says, you know what, if we just install a few lines of code, we can pass every emissions test in the United States of America. And somebody gave them the thumbs up. The idea that the smartest, best engineering automotive firm the world has ever seen is saying, well, you know, a couple engineers snuck this baby in on us, and boy, when we found out about it, we were absolutely flabbergasted. Now, do you think in that boardroom, which literally has the best engineering minds on the world, in the world, somebody didn't say, how are we doing this? How are we passing these EPA tests using this system?
Or I would imagine that you would expect that their internal quality control mm-hmm. would have done similar tests to the ones that were ultimately done that found this out, right? Like, it's one thing to say, okay, we're going to test emissions sitting here in the garage here at the Volkswagen. And then, of course, we're going to take it on the track, and we're going to test emissions there.
Of course.
Had they taken it on the track, they would have seen it, right?
Got
this was all discovered.
The idea that this was somehow a rogue engineering group at Volkswagen who installed it in there to placate their bosses is absurd, and it's insulting. And they knew exactly what they were doing. They knew exactly how to do it, and they went for it. They went for it because they knew the EPA testing is so poor, so awful, so self-serving, that they knew they could get away with it.
Well, it seems to me there was also one other element that sort of was shielding them, and that was, and I don't know how familiar you are with this, my understanding that the Digital Millennium Copyright Act prevented their software, basically shielded their software from third-party off-label outfits to sort of do any work, ostensibly to do any work on the cars, right? I mean, everybody got the same protections from this, but in this case, it basically hid that they had nefarious code. What do you think is going to happen to that now? Because I know the EPA was actually saying, had supposedly taken the position of like, yes, you've got to protect their codes that work on emissions because you don't want like Joe, the mechanic who works down the street, to say, hey, come in, I'll tweak your
thing.
But
Sam, they're doing that now. I mean, in other words, everybody knows about aftermarket software and chips. They call it, the old days, you put a new chip in to make your car get, 30% more horsepower and drive fast. I mean, it isn't like this hasn't been done, or the fact that this is a trade secret on the code. Any guy with the proper diagnostic equipment, they do it all the time. I can get online right now.
Right.
I think ARL is the number one leading aftermarket supplier for these cars to make them go real fast. And all they do is you're rewriting code on the system. It's trade secrets to the extent, and which is fair. I mean, every company should have their own trade secrets. That's a competitive advantage. The problem with these guys did, it wasn't a trade secret. Everybody knew about defeat devices, but you're not supposed to do them. They're illegal.
Right.
And they just said, you know what, to hell with it. There's a really good Consumer Reports. Somebody gets a chance to see it. There's about a 3-minute video they did. And they actually took two cars, the 2011 and the 2015, and they tested them in the factory mode, and then they tested them on the EPA mode and showed how you defeat the EPA testing. It's a fascinating little video. It's 3 minutes long, and I recommend people to look at it. It'll explain it really well.
Okay, so if there's criminal charges brought, that's going to come from the U.S. government, from the Department
DOJ
of Justice.
You may have some really rogue, strong state attorney generals who are going to say, hey, you know what? These are not just civil fines. When you are literally poisoning people, this rises to a higher level of culpability.
Right.
And I hope it goes that high.
Okay, so from your perspective as a civil attorney, what is the argument that you're going to make? Okay, I mean, are you going to have a class? You're going to bring a class action suit against them?
That's one of the. That's right now. It's so early. It'll be some sort of mass tort. It'll be there. We call it a class versus mass because we just don't know yet about how that's going to go.
And so, what will be the theory of damages? I mean. Is it like how do you make somebody whole in this situation? Is it like,
let me give
a Camry.
Okay, let me give an example. Let's start at this. Sam wants to go in and buy himself a clean diesel car because you know what? It's just the right thing to do.
Huh?
I'm salesman and I say, Sam, here's the deal. I need kind of a wink and a nod, but I'm gonna level with you. I'm gonna sell you this car and the truth of the matter is, we say it's a clean diesel, but between us, we kind of rigged it, and it's not even close to being clean. But, man, it gets 60 miles a gallon. It'll go 150 miles an hour. And the odds are you're probably not going to get caught, okay? Good price. It's great. But it's illegal. Now, Sam going to take out his checkbook
and buying that car?
Right.
Of course he's not. What he's going to say is, are you out of your mind?
Right.
Why would I do this? So Sam's now going to go back in, hopefully with good counsel, and say, you know what? Here's your car. I paid $28,262.98, and you need to write me a check for $28,262.89, pay my attorney's fees. And by the way, I'm pretty pissed off that I destroyed the environment. You need to pay me for that, too. So that's the element of damages.
Okay. So that's an extraordinary amount of money for Volkswagen.
I hope so.
Yeah, I mean, I don't... And do you think, I mean, is it possible this in some way ends this company?
Not even. It's a rounding error over a period of 5 years.
Oh, really?
Okay, how's BP doing today?
Well, yeah, I know. But, I mean, this is every one of their products, right?
The growth revenue, the BP and Volkswagen, almost similar. Volkswagen did $218 billion last year.
Wow.
They're the largest company in Europe. 750,000 employees. 600,000 employees in Germany.
Do you think that? I mean, I guess this is not something that you would find out until and if you get to discovery. Mm-hmm. But just how, like, sort of sophisticated, like, what, like, what's the end game here? Like, someday we're going to invent. I mean,
yep.
I can see, like, okay, we did this for 1 year. Yep. But I put every single engineer, you know, like, I could see you find the memo. Okay, here it is. We'll get away with this for 12 months.
Yep.
But we are going to dedicate every resource we have in this company so that after 12 months, we will figure out our own system like they have with Mercedes. If we have to expand the bodies of the Rabbit by 6 inches on the left, and we will do it, but we just need this 1 year, you know. And then it becomes sort of like more of like this sort of tragedy, you know. But it doesn't have that feeling that they're just like, oh, we found the solution. Let's just pretend we never did.
Right. No, and that is what's so evil, sinister, and venal about what they've done. They know how to fix it. In other words, they knew that back in 2009. They just made a decision that due to the profitability of not installing a $6,000 urea system, that if we put in two little lines of code, we become the number one selling diesel in the United States. Our profitability on these cars is double what our competitors is. And if we get caught, we got to pay some fines. And so let's do our risk-benefit analysis. We sold billions and billions of dollars worth of cars. If we get caught, we throw our hands up, toss a few engineers under the bus, say a mea culpa, hope to God we can negotiate a $2 or $3 billion EPA fine, and move on down the road.
But don't they also realize, like, there's going to be some type of suit, or is that just they calculate that?
Sure, that's the cost of doing business. Volkswagen has had class action filed against them in the past many times. This is not their first rodeo. sad to say, but cost of doing business for these guys is, it's very similar to the drug industry, and that is, look, we know we're going to get the drug pulled off the market. So we're going to lie about our clinical trials. We'll pass the FDA, and if we kill 200 or 300 people and injure 10,000, we've sold $3.9 billion worth of drug. We're going to now have to pay out $800 million in settlements. So we cleared $2.5 billion. Okay. You know what? Believe it or not, they can actually live with themselves with that.
Well, you know, that is what I've asked. Every year I find myself asking at least one attorney this, like, how jaded does this? Because and when you say this stuff, I mean, when I say this, you know, describe that dynamic, it is founded upon hearsay. You know, I've talked to lawyers who have sat there and read through the documents and just seen it in black and white. Here's the memo where they say, you know, they don't lay it out quite that succinctly, but it's pretty close, isn't it?
Oh, it is. It's. I remember one drug case I had, seriously. The marketing, and this, I'm not making this up, and it's under confidentiality agreement, so it's, I can't tell you what drug company it was, but the memo was they actually had a death poll amongst the marketing, and it was, you've got to pick the number of deaths that were going to be reported that month, and you won the pool. Not making that up.
From their drug?
Yeah. True story.
Holy.
And we couldn't disclose the memo because we were in a confidentiality agreement. But, yeah, I mean, I remember late at night going through the documents, seeing that, and I just said, you've got to be, and it really was. And it was like a humorous thing. I got 25 this month. Okay, I'll take 27. Okay, I'll do 31.
Now, these are the reps? Yeah. Or are these?
The reps are marketing people. Yeah.
Are they the worst in the company? Or are they?
They're the most jaded because they know. They're on the front lines, and they know anecdotally when bad things are happening more than anybody because they're getting it from the nurses, the doctors. And you think they're going to really report that because it's a blockbuster drug and they're making $300,000 a year selling this thing? Cost-benefit analysis.
Right. I bet they also are the most jaded because they will report, if they report that back, what they get back.
They'll be selling snowballs in Alaska.
Right.
Right.
And my guess is also that my sense is that a lot of these reps, anyways, on drugs, and we're going a little far afield of Volkswagen, but they have compliance officers who say, like, hey, I'm really serious this time. No more off-labeling of this drug, even though there's so much evidence that it clears acne or that it provides weight loss.
Sure.
Just be very careful that those words, that it provides weight loss and relieves acne, don't come out of your
mouth. Well, now, we're not making any representation that it may be infectious or there may, we're not saying it is effective for that off-label use, but it can't hurt.
It's fascinating to me. But so what do you think the timeline is going to be on the VW
thing? It'll be fast. VW is going to do the follow-up, and I gave a talk on this yesterday. My topic was what will Volkswagen do? And they've got a couple options. And if you don't mind, we have time. This is the greatest anecdote. It's a true story.
Please.
Happened 2 days ago. So a client of mine, he goes, Mr. Maloney, you know I like Volkswagen. It's my third one. And I called up my dealer, and they said, Billy, come on in here. We are going to make it right. We are going to make it right. Goes into the dealership, and they say, Billy, you got that 2013 Jet out there, don't you? 2013, you owe about $15,000 on it. You know what we're going to do? We're going to do what's called a substitution of collateral on your loan. And we're going to take that Jetta off the note, and we're going to put you in a 2015 Passat Limited Edition, a $32,000 car. What do you think about that, Billy? You're getting yourself a $32,000 car for the price of a Jetta. He called me and said, Mr. Maloney, I told you these guys were going to treat me right. I told you they were going to do the right thing. And I went, Billy, man, if they're doing that, yeah, that's a hell of a deal. You're getting a $32,000 car for a $15,000 note. But I said, before you sign anything, would you mind sending me over that paperwork? Just let me look at it. Send it over. And first couple pages look legit. Well, stuck in the fifth page was a purchase agreement. And what they had done was roll a new note in for Billy to where they had taken the difference between the $15,000 and the $30,000 and rolled it into a note. To where now Billy, instead of having a $15,000 loan, had a $32,000 loan. So all they had done was sell him a new car.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. That's the scam that's going on now.
Yeah, that's just that's just stunning.
Yeah. That's absolutely true. I said, Bill, he was heartbroken. He was heartbroken. I can't believe they would do this to me.
What did he do? Did he go back to the dealership?
Oh, I went back there and I said, you dirty SOB, here's your contract, throw it in their face and say, give him his damn car back.
Like, what did they look at? Like, I don't understand. Like, I just don't.
Okay, when you walk into a car dealership, are you ever comfortable thinking that you're not getting screwed?
Look, to be honest with
you. Well, if you live in New York, you probably don't have a car.
Never bought a new car, but I just don't understand how people do business. How
they go home at night.
Yeah, that amazes me. I mean, and it's.
Well, how about putting out eleven million cars that are killing people?
It's a stunning story. And
yeah, it is.
It really makes you wonder. it makes you just wonder just about, I guess, sort of corporations in general. I mean, there's something that turns people into.
They've lost their way, and they've lost their way in the sense that it really is the idea of, we understand that we're going to get caught one day, but you know what? We will make enough money to justify the payback. And that really has become the mentality.
Why do you think, I mean, this is outside of your portfolio perhaps, but why do you think, does this happen more than it used to? Or is it just there's something about what happens when people get into a corporate structure that is, and maybe the corporate structure in some respects is designed this way.
Right.
So that like the human part, like conscious, like the things that would stop us from doing them as individuals, there's something about the corporate structure that sort of makes it that much easier to do.
The collective demands one thing, and that is numbers. If you don't get me the numbers, somebody else will. If you don't get me the numbers, you're out. And these guys, like drug companies, car companies, similar, if we don't sell 9 million units this year, you're gone. I'll find me somebody who will sell 9 million units. And the intense pressure to keep the stock price up, to create a blockbuster drug, to create clean diesel, the pressure is so immense from the stockholders, from the boardroom. They want results, and they don't care how you get the results. The result isn't the fact that some kid is choking to death breathing this crap. The result is we had a 19% increase in sales the last quarter. That is the mentality.
Unbelievable. Tim Maloney from Maloney and Campolo in San Antonio, Texas. Thanks so much for your time today. Really
enjoyed,
appreciate it.
Joy talking to you.
Just an unbelievable story. But I have just been joined by Chris Paulos of Levin Papantonio, and he is here to discuss with us the DuPont case regarding C8, and this is a big deal, folks. We've talked in the past about C8, I believe we had interviewed on our program Sharon Lerner from The Intercept, and she did a three-part story on this. I want to welcome back to the show, because Chris, we've talked before in the past, haven't we?
That's right. Yes, it's nice to be here with you this morning. Appreciate the opportunity to discuss these issues with you.
So you are part of the trial team, and so you just got back from a month where in Virginia, right?
Yeah, we were just in Columbus, Ohio, and we had our first bellwether trial in the Southern District of Ohio. The cases are from West Virginia and Ohio. About 3,500 cases have been filed so far by residents of Ohio and West Virginia who drank contaminated drinking water and have now developed certain series of diseases. We got a verdict last Thursday after a four-week trial. It was a plaintiff's verdict. The case was Carla Bartlett versus DuPont. It was a gun battle in the courtroom. It was a roller coaster. DuPont was very well represented, and they came out swinging. They've been fighting these cases now for almost two decades at various stages and from various in various lawsuits, and this was the first personal injury, single individual case to go forward. And Carla Bartlett went up against one of the largest chemical corporations in the world, and she won. And we're very pleased with the result.
Okay, so now Mike Papantonio, who my audience obviously knows quite well, I've been co-hosting on Ring of Fire. He was telling me a little bit about the case. Apparently, his closing argument was a lot of fun to watch, and I really wish I had been there for this. But so let's walk through this, because there's a couple of things that are slightly unique about this, at least in terms of an approach as far as I understand it. And we should also say that DuPont, this is sort of, I mean, DuPont has a long history of doing things that show an a virulent disregard for human life. I mean, it seems to me, at least in terms of a byproduct of their profits. Putting that aside for the moment. So they're making this, they're making products. What is C8? Is it a byproduct or is it actually just...
Well, it, yeah, it is. It is a byproduct. But C8 is. It's actually. I can, if I can say it right. The chemical name is perfluorooctanoic acid, and they call it C8 because nobody can actually say the real name.
Right.
And they call it C8 because it's a fluorinated carbon chemical. It's got eight carbon chain or eight carbon molecules on a chain that all have a fluoride connected to it, and that makes it rather unique in the sense that. It's they described it, DuPont described it, as just like a soap or a detergent. And it's used to help coat the machines and the pipes and things through which the Teflon product is being pushed or created. And it just kind of smooths the process out for them. But it doesn't
So it's not even a byproduct of it. It is actually a second element that's brought in in the process of making it.
Exactly.
Oh,
it's
it's okay.
Called a surfactant.
Did they create C8? I mean, who developed C8?
Well, the 3M Corporation was the predominant supplier to DuPont for many, many years. One of the more compelling facts about the case was that when 3M learned, and they knew for a while that this chemical, because of its carbon chain, was very biopersistent. In fact, at trial, DuPont's own witnesses had to testify that they couldn't tell anybody how long it will remain in the environment. It could be 2,000 years. It just doesn't break down. It's very persistent. And that's what makes this stay around in somebody's body for so long. It's bioaccumulative, meaning if you're exposed to it, it doesn't leave your body for a very long time. So the half-life of C8 in your body is 5 years. So if somebody who gets exposed to C8 and then... get the exposure stops, it's going to take 20 years for all the C8 to leave their body. And that's the scary thing about this chemical. And when 3M realized the biopersistence issues, the toxicity issues, the bioaccumulative issues, they stopped making the chemical. And they told DuPont, we're getting out of the C8 business because of we think it's the right thing to do. And what did DuPont do? They went and they built a $25 million plant in Fayetteville, North Carolina, to start making their own C8 and kept using it at their factory and pumping it into the river. So as opposed to following the manufacturer's lead, they became their own manufacturer. And then we're making it all the way up until this year. DuPont just phased C8 out of the Teflon production process in Parkersburg, West Virginia in 2015, and only because they were forced to agree to do that by the EPA once they got involved.
Oh, my God. So in this case is basically the class of people that are involved in this case are people who live next to that plant that was manufacturing the C8.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, here's where it gets sort of interesting and in why this case, this individual case is amazing. It's not often, is my understanding, that you will do an individual case to represent a class. Is that right?
Yeah, and this is, I think, one of the most compelling things about this story is not just how long DuPont was using this product or using this chemical, and how blatant they were with its disposal or dumping of it in the Ohio River in the air, but the fact that they have gone to the mat for 17 years in court in various lawsuits, and so the way it really started. Was there was a lawsuit that was filed by one brave farmer in Parkersburg, West Virginia, in the late 90s, a gentleman who's no longer with us. In fact, he died of cancer. His name is Wilbur Tennant, and he had a family cattle farm, and they'd been in his family for 150 years. And in 1 year, he lost just over 200 head of cattle. And right next door to his property was a DuPont landfill, and that had a creek running through his land, that the DuPont landfill was leaching into. And
is this the guy who shot footage?
That's right.
Okay, yeah, yeah. I don't know where I've seen this.
That was probably part
of
the Intercept article. Yes, they had some video that Mr. Tennant had taken of his cows, and he actually had performed his own autopsies and sent the videos to regulators and complained. And part of this lawsuit was capturing this black foaming water in what was called Dry Run Creek. During this lawsuit that was filed by a tenacious trial lawyer out of Cincinnati named Robert Bellott, it was discovered that C8 had been illegally dumped into the Dry Run landfill. But what's even more nefarious is that during this first lawsuit, DuPont never disclosed that C8 was in the Dry Run landfill. They kept telling Wilbur Tennant through the discovery process, well, here's everything we put in there. We don't know what killed your cows. And then they put together a team of veterinarians to come in and basically slander Mr. Tennant and say it was his farming practices that killed all of his cows. This is a guy who's been raising cows and with his family for hundreds of years.
Right.
And one year he kills 200 cows because of his herd management practices. But what DuPont never even told this team of veterinarians was that there was C8 in the Dry Run landfill. So when the veterinarians made that determination and that finding in this first lawsuit, they had no idea that C8 was even in the water.
It was just because there was no other explanation.
Yeah, and so it's pretty crazy. And Rob Bellott, in the millions of pages of documents that he found, he came across one word, and it was FC-143. And they had found a document that said something about FC-143 being present in the Dry Run landfill. He figured out that that was the trade name that 3M had given to C8, and he realized that that was what was that now in the water.
So that document, that's a document that is that was generated by DuPont internally using basically like a code name.
Well, yeah, they were calling it FC-143, and they would, whenever they talked
and
about.
And so, what did they do? Did they go over there and test that that bed? Is that what was going?
Antonio's going to meet with all the villagers.
Okay.
DuPont had known since the mid 1980s that FC-143 was in the Dry Run landfill and that it was leaching into the groundwater, and they didn't tell anybody. And they didn't tell anybody about it during that lawsuit until Rob Bellott discovered it. And what's even better is that we have documents from the moment that Rob Bellott and Wilbur Tennant discovered the FC-143 and Dry Run landfill, because we have emails from their own lawyers saying, holy smokes, they've discovered the FC-143 and Dry Run, what are we going to do now? And their entire litigation process and the cover-up of that of the contamination went just exploded from there. And so it's very compelling, because that's
and
what
so
blew
when
the lid
was
off.
That? When was that?
That was in 1999. So in 1999, once they discovered FC-143 in Dry Run Landfill, they settled with Mr. Tennant. Then Rob Bellott and his team figured out that the FC-143 had gotten into the aquifer and had contaminated the water of 6 water districts around Parkersburg, West Virginia. And then Rob filed lawsuits, class action lawsuits, on behalf of the residents whose water had been contaminated. And DuPont litigated those for about 5 years. Finally settled it around 2005, and in 2005, part of that settlement, DuPont agreed to put together a team of independent scientists to look at FC-143/C8 and determine what sort of diseases it may cause. And they agreed to be bound by the findings of this science panel. And then what the science panel found after 6 years of epidemiological research and study of the populations in and around Parkersburg, West Virginia, was that there is a probable link to 6 diseases from C8. Testicular cancer, kidney cancer, ulcerative colitis, preeclampsia, hyperlipidemia, and I'm missing one. Did I say ulcerative colitis?
Yeah.
Already? Thyroid disease. And so all of the residents that have one of those or more of those, any of those injuries that had consumed that drinking water at a certain amount for a certain duration of time has a claim that they can now file against DuPont. And that's where at least 3,500 cases are. They're residents from Parkersburg, West Virginia, that have these types of diseases.
Okay. Now, because I have heard bits and pieces of this story over the past couple of years here, and now it all makes sense. So that when 6 years ago, when Bellott was able to set up this independent, sort of a court-mandated, independent board that determined the epidemiological connection between C8 and these diseases. Mm-hmm. That was pretty revolutionary, wasn't it, in terms of like the way these types of cases are handled.
Well, the thing that makes it unique is that that was part of the settlement agreement. I mean, DuPont had to come in and provide granulated activated charcoal filtration for all these water districts to remove the C8 from their water. They had to do all sorts of other remedial steps in response to being caught and being fined the largest fine in U.S. history by the EPA for their conduct. And then they agreed to this science panel. And the reason it was so unique is because this is a chemical that the EPA really had no idea existed or what it really was. That what's interesting is people think that the EPA has a team of scientists that study every chemical known to man. Absolutely not. It's much like the FDA in the sense that the EPA requires chemical makers or people who use chemicals to disclose to them the existence of a chemical and what that the toxicity of that chemical is, so that then the EPA can decide to regulate it. Well, C8 was never a regulated chemical, so water districts were never testing for it in their water because they didn't know it existed and they didn't know it was toxic, and so it wasn't something that they normally test for. But what we now know is it is incredibly toxic, it's incredibly biopersistent, and now it's something that, in fact, if people go and look at their water district annual report, you'll see a acronym, PFOA, that's basically C8, and you'll see trace amounts in your own water at home.
Municipalities do this?
They do now, and the EPA has provided now draft guidance to water districts as to the amount of C8 that should be in your water or that could be in your water. And the scary thing about this is that this is a man-made chemical. It doesn't occur naturally. And the handful of chemical manufacturers and plastics manufacturers like DuPont that used this chemical have quite literally poisoned the entire world, and we don't know how long this stuff will be around. It is in everybody. We're sitting in a large room right now with hundreds of people around us. Everybody will have trace amounts of C8 in their blood if you were to test it.
Okay, all right. There's a whole lot of things I want to unpack here, because you know you're right about that idea about, like, you know, people perceive the EPA. I think people would be surprised, like, sort of across the board. I mean, this comes up with, like, fracking. It comes up even with, like, autopsies, frankly. There's always an assumption that you test the water, you test the blood, and all these different elements pop up. There's one test, and it's just like, oh, we've got 63 things in your blood. That's not the way it works. You need to actually have a specific test and know what you're testing for. There is no, we're just generally testing it. And I found this out because my wife does works on some murder documentary shows, and mm-hmm. the story of how a wife killed her husband and I don't want to release any trade secrets, but with a coolant.
Okay.
Apparently, you know, the way if you're getting a lot of sweet desserts, be wary all of a sudden, because the coolant is very sweet. Feed it to you slowly, and then just your brain pops, basically. And there's no reason for a coroner to ever check to see if there's coolant in your system, because you're a human being. But if there is, if they go and look for that and they find it, then they realize it. And so it's the same dynamic here. So coming out of that one case, the second case, I guess, mm-hmm. when Balot realized, hey, if this farmer has a problem with this, if the C8 got here, it's likely that it could be over here. And mm-hmm. so they went and tested for it. The results of that case are two major things. One, it changes the reporting for municipalities across the entire country.
Well, like, they become aware of it in being in the water, in the drinking water. This is such a biopersistent chemical that they're finding it in trace amounts in the wildlife in the Arctic. And it is spread through the world.
And so how many other companies are still, or how many other plants are making C8 in this country?
Well, right at this point, most responsible manufacturers have phased it out, and they've gone to different fluorinated compounds. Again, unregulated chemicals that have less carbon in it, C6, C5, and whose toxicity is not well known at this point. So they've changed it. And then like 3M, they just stopped making it altogether, and they found other surfactants that are less toxic that they use to make these products. And that's one of the other.
So if I get something from Scotchgard now, like if I get a Scotchgard treated couch today, I'm okay?
I can't tell you if that's true, because Scotchgard is made with a different chemical called PFOS, which is much more toxic than PFOA, which is C8. And when 3M phased out their PFOA, their C8, they also phased out PFOS, which was what they used in their Scotchgard products, because of their concern about its biopersistence in the environment.
So if it's a new couch, they're not using it?
No, they can vary, depending on who you got it from. It could be in there, but keep in mind, it's not an ingredient of Teflon. It's not an ingredient of Scotchgard. It's a chemical that's used to make those products. So when you cook it on your pots
chemical,
and pans at home with the Teflon coating, there's not C8 inside the Teflon.
Ah, okay.
So that's something that we had to be very clear with the jury at this trial, was this is just something that goes into, they mix it up and they put it in the pipes, and it doesn't.
So it's basically like grease on some level.
Yeah, it's, in fact, DuPont's own lawyer described, the analogy he used was that it's like cooking spray. It's not an ingredient to the food that you're cooking, it's just something that helps you cook.
So let me ask you this about the Teflon. I mean, when I cook with cooking spray, I imagine it's on my food.
Yeah.
Is there C8 or some similar compound?
So when Teflon products come out, they're sold to people who will then take, say, a Teflon powder that they're going to take to their own manufacturing plant and get sprayed onto pots and pans. Yeah, on that powder, there's trace amounts of C8. And what DuPont was doing was sending those products through heating ovens to burn off the C8. What DuPont wasn't doing, which was all of the air that is admitted through the machines and through the smokestacks at Parkersburg, West Virginia, they weren't heating that up to a point where it would destroy the C8. And then there was also wastewater. The C8 would be in the water that they used to cool the machines and to make the products. That was being dumped right into the Ohio River.
So they would strip the C8. So when we get that Teflon pan, it's not on the Teflon.
Yeah.
However, it's in their backyard, essentially.
Well, it took C8 to make that Teflon, and that C8 doesn't get consumed in the process, and it has to go somewhere. What we do know is that DuPont was told that the best way to dispose of C8 was through incineration. When 3M was providing this material to DuPont, they would hand them what was called a material safety data sheet that says, here's all the information that we know about this chemical. We don't know how you're going to use it, so you're on your own, buddy. You know, you take care and use your best judgment on how to use this chemical, but we recommend to you that any waste be incinerated. And they never were doing that. They never incinerated their waste. They simply dumped it to the Ohio River and then out of their smokestacks. So they were using a chemical in contradiction to the own manufacturer's instructions.
Okay, so let's get to this specific case. So you get this this body is created. It shows a direct link between C8 exposure and these six diseases. You go around essentially a concentric circle, or a radius of the plant, and find 3,500 people who are suffering from this disease.
Or 3,500 people found us. I mean, there's so many people that were living in that area that who may have moved away and may not even be aware of this case, but they could be a claimant because they drank the water for so long and have a disease.
Is there a statistical bump in all these diseases within that geographic area?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things that the science panel had to do to make the determination of a probable link, is they had to look at the population in and around that area.
There's no chance there would be this many cases of ulcerous colitis in this small geographic
location. The rates of those diseases were statistically significant, and it was significantly increased.
So the first case... Now, explain this to me. This was a defense pick, right?
That's right. That's
and,
right.
And that means that out of those 3,500 cases, and there could be more, but these are the first 3,500 who've come up and said, I have this disease. I live within this radius. or I have this disease and I live within this radius. And I say that because one of these 3,500 cases was a woman who had cancer but has been in remission, and probably, according to her doctor, the cancer's not coming back. Been in remission for 20 years, not coming back. She lived at the outer edge of that radius, is my understanding. And the defense had the opportunity to pick which of these 3,500 or so cases they wanted to try first.
Mm-hmm.
And their theory is, we're going to pick a case that we are sure to win, because then it makes it harder to pursue those other cases, right? It sets sort of like...
It sends a signal to other claimants. And
it scares the law firm, right? Yeah, because you guys at 11 Pound Petroleum, I mean, this stuff has been going on for 25 years. This takes an enormous amount of money up front, right? I mean, because somebody's... I presume, Chris, you get paid.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, they picked this case. The parties, the way it's set up is that there's a bellwether process. Because there's 3,500 of these cases, the most efficient and economic way to handle such a large litigation is to pick cases that are representative of all the other cases that are behind it. And to try those cases, to see how a jury responds to either side's theories of liability, and to put some numbers on the board so that you can start to contemplate what is the true exposure to this company, what are the things that resonate with the jury and what don't. And it allows the other side to start to see how if you had to try every single one of these cases, how it may go. And it's designed to give the parties guidance for global resolution. So in some mass tort cases, you'll go through 6, 7, maybe sometimes 8 bellwether trials, and the plaintiffs will win some, the defense will win some, and that helps you figure out and look at that mass of cases that are coming behind it. Okay, we could probably win on all these cases because of X, Y, and Z facts, and we might lose on all of these cases because 1, 2, and 3 facts, or the juries are not, and then they basically create a method of resolving the cases globally. Because
so that can either be through actual litigation, mm-hmm. or it could be you have enough information where both sides say, like, look, I think we can come to a deal here.
Yeah.
It's clear that 70% of mm-hmm. your plaintiffs, they could probably win, and 30% not. So let's make a deal.
Mm-hmm.
And theoretically, for those 70%, or we'll make a deal. You guys deal with how you're going to divvy it up amongst the claimants.
Yeah, I mean, it basically, the bellwether process is designed to drive global resolution of large mass tort cases. And the reason that it's so significant that this was a defense pick case, this first case, called the Carla Bartlett case, was because this is just my personal opinion, what I'm thinking, is that the court wanted the defense to be able to put a case forward first. Because if the defense can't win a case that they picked, they should probably think long and hard about settling this case.
Right.
And they did pick Ms. Bartlett's case for a few reasons that I can speculate on, and I think it was kind of obvious during their presentation of their case why they picked Ms. Bartlett's case.
What was their angle? Like that she had cancer in the past, but she doesn't have cancer
now.
Well,
I think they picked her case because it's a very early case in the timeline of everything. So she developed cancer in 1997. It was a kidney cancer. It was discovered by accident. She went in to have a gallbladder surgery, and they found a lump on her kidney. And it turned out to be a cancerous growth. She went in. She had the cancer removed from her kidney. She had what's called a partial nephrectomy. They took out part of her kidney, and then stitched her up. She didn't have to go through chemotherapy. She had a rather smooth recovery, but obviously lives every day with fear of recurrence of cancer. Every time she gets a phone call from the doctors, she chill goes down her spine.
Yeah, like to go and have half their kidney removed.
Well, and that's really how the defense said is they kept saying, she's cured. She's cured.
Right.
Yeah, she went in for a surgery. She was in the hospital for 3 days, but she hasn't had cancer since. What's she so afraid of? Well, what she's afraid of, and what everybody in that area should be afraid of, is biopersistence.
Right.
Even though she had cancer and had a surgery where her own doctor testified to get this piece of her kidney out, they basically had to cut her in half.
Okay.
She still has C8 in her blood today. So she had to sit there for 4 weeks and listen to testimony about how dangerous this chemical is, knowing that she's still got a lot of C8 in her blood that could cause additional cancer.
Now, their argument at that point, like, hey, she's got no cancer anymore, is that an argument about damages?
Yes. Okay. So they tried to minimize her damages.
So she's got not much damages. And did they try and make an argument about causality or...
They tried.
Okay, so what was their... that's really the two... Right, these are the two elements of a tort case. It really is damages and... in the event that they're, maybe it goes actually reverse, it's did we cause the harm? Mm-hmm. And then how much harm did we really cause?
Yeah.
And so what did they try and argue on the did we cause the harm front?
Well, the another interesting thing about this case is, like we discussed before, the science panel's findings. And DuPont agreed to be bound by those findings. And the science panel found what, gets a little legalistic, is you have two types of causation you have to prove. General causation. Does this chemical or this product generally cause these diseases? Tobacco. We know for a fact that tobacco causes lung cancer. General causation was presumed in this case because DuPont agreed to be bound by the science panel. So we didn't have to prove that C8 caused kidney cancer, but we still had to prove what's called specific causation,
that
which is
that
it caused her cancer. Okay. So this is where they came in and attacked Ms. Bartlett. And they're, believe it or not, they're... They're experts, and I hate to call them experts because they're simply just a paid puppet, but they came in to say that Carla Bartlett's kidney cancer was caused by her obesity, by her body weight, by eating too much food.
Okay.
And that's what they said with a straight face, that kidney cancer can be caused by obesity, and there's absolutely no scientific foundation for that. If that's the case, we would see an epidemic of kidney cancer in our country that should follow along the lines of the epidemic of obesity, but we don't. But that's literally all they could come in and try to say, because Ms. Bartlett had no other reason that she should have kidney cancer.
So, and this is in their estimation, their best case.
This is, they came in, they said, geez, they basically said, she has no damages. She's cured of cancer. She's fine.
Right.
No damages. And then because of the date of her injury in 1997, what they did then is they came in and they said, Your Honor, your court, nothing after 1997, none of our conduct, none of our documents, none of our emails should ever come in because they're all irrelevant. They're after the fact that she got kidney cancer. What's relevant is everything before 1997. What's significant about that is that in 1997, by 1997, internally, DuPont had determined that this was a carcinogen and never told anybody. And then their most egregious conduct that would subject them to punitive damages, that would show that they acted with a conscious disregard for the public,
comes after 1997. They have determined. So it's their level of knowledge about what they were actually doing. I mean, they knew they were putting C8 into the water, but at one point they knew, not only are we doing that, we know it's a poison.
Yeah, and after 1997, the internal documents become... and again, think about this. This is before Rob Bellot filed his lawsuit and anybody discovered C8 was in Dry Run Landfill. After that, in 1999, you start seeing the cover-up inside these documents. So,
interesting. So this gets to the specific causality, or I should say it gets to the specific culpability they had at that time, which I guess is a third element, their state of mind here, as opposed to, like, we did this accidentally, we had no way
basically,
of knowing.
Basically, their foreseeability of the harm. So could they have foreseen that people like Ms. Bartlett would be injured by this chemical?
And the fact is that when you start to put poison in people, it's relatively foreseeable. Yeah. A reasonable person would say, this is going to hurt people.
When you've been dumping hundreds of thousands of pounds of this stuff into the Ohio River, it's generally foreseeable that somebody that drinks that water might have
injured. And they made the mistake of assuming, based upon what they got in discovery or what they saw that you guys had, that there was no document, no evidence that they knew about this before 1990.
No, there was, and there was plenty of it. And we think even if the, and, you know,
but they made the mistake of thinking that you didn't know that.
Yeah, well, and I think it would have taken away a lot of the story, a lot of what of DuPont's conduct, and kept that away from the jury. The court, and I think rightfully and wisely so, said absolutely not. Punitive damages is a part of this case, and part of punitive damages is the reprehensibility of DuPont's conduct and everything that happened after 1997. If, you know, if the plaintiffs are alleging there was cover-up and there was a delay to the public, and that's maybe why Ms. Bartlett didn't find out until 2006 that she had C8 in her blood, mm-hmm. and then figured out finally that might be what caused her kidney cancer in 2012 when the science panel made that finding, then that's all coming in and that's all part of the story, and the jury does get to hear about that. And so we were still able to put evidence on from 1997 and onward. But that's one reason I think they picked this case, because it's an early case. And so they thought they might be able to exclude a lot of evidence that would be very damaging for them.
So she was awarded by the jury how much money?
She got $1.6 million for her injury.
All right, folks. Here's the time for you to whip out your calculators. There are 3,500 plaintiffs as of today. That number could increase, and I would think would likely increase as this gets more publicity. 3,500 times 1.7 million, just, I can't do the 0.7 in my head.
It's almost $6 billion.
$6 billion.
Yes.
And the CEO of DuPont resigned recently.
Yeah, she resigned. I thought it was interesting. She resigned a week before we got our verdict. I'm not saying there's any connection between that or and what was happening in the courtroom at the time. But I just thought the timing was somewhat interesting.
You know, I mean, my sense is that if there is, DuPont has just a long, I can't remember what else they were working with, lead or was
you,
it?
You name it. I mean, it is.
They have a long history of showing incredible disregard for their workers, the consumers, people who live around their plants. I mean, if there was ever an opportunity for a death penalty for a company, it seems to me it would be with these guys.
Yeah. Well, and what's another interesting thing is that, you know, the rules of evidence don't really allow us to talk about the past, what would be considered irrelevant past transgressions of DuPont. So we can't come in and attack DuPont's character for everything that they've done in the past and all these other mistakes that they've made and other criminal acts that
right.
they've committed. Because that would just be so prejudicial,
right.
and it could affect the case and the facts that were about at bar. But what DuPont did do in their defense is they came in and they said, we're the leading chemical corporation in the world. We're doing all these things that no other chemical corporation does. We have this amazing laboratory. We're an industry leader in that we have our own laboratory called Haskell Labs that studied CI. That knew everything they could about
it. Is Haskell their internal sort of like toxicology?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
And they're right when they say DuPont, they're the only chemical company in the world that has a world's leading toxicology laboratory. But the reason they have Haskell Labs is that in the 1920s they killed several hundred people
right.
of their own employees and believe it or not, bladder cancer.
Right.
What was that
they were manufacturing? I remember.
I can't remember the chemical exactly,
yeah,
but it was up in the Northeast. They killed a lot of people.
And then the story goes. My understanding is that they ignored what the Haskell Laboratories actually
that's part of this case. But the reason they have Haskell Labs is because of this incident there where they killed a lot of people. But we obviously weren't allowed to get into the backstory
right.
of why they had this world-leading laboratory. They also came in and said they were doing all these things, working with community groups and setting up a board of community members that they would communicate issues about the Parkersburg plant with. Well, the reason they have to set up these community groups is because of an incident that happened in India where they killed thousands of other people, and it has now become an industry mandate for all chemical companies to create these community-based organizations. What's that?
Were they Bhopal? No, that was... Was it DuPont in India?
It was a different chemical, different chemical company. But all chemical companies now are required to bring in members of the community to communicate assertively
with
the community.
That was Union Carbide. Okay. Well, Chris Apollos, thank you so much for sort of laying this out. And I imagine like the next step is either you start to try more cases, or DuPont realizes like, we have a major problem here, and
we've got our next case set for December 1st. It's a plaintiff pick case, It's a case that involves a severe case of ulcerative colitis, which is a very debilitating disease and something that you would never want to have to experience.
I have a good friend who suffers.
So we are looking forward to getting that case in front of the jury. We're ready to go. We're sure that DuPont has huddled up and thought long and hard about the last results. And they will again come out swinging if that's what they
choose to do. And this is
going to
be in Virginia?
This will be in Ohio, yeah, Southern District of Ohio. Okay. So if DuPont decides they want to keep trying these cases, we're prepared to do that. For our clients and folks out there that are listening that may be part of this community, they may have questions about these chemicals, they can feel free to contact us. There's also lots of information on the internet now about C8. I think you talked about the Intercept articles, and
yep.
There's been New York Times, Huffington Post, and Intercept articles that have covered the story. They've done a very good job of laying out the facts so that people can know about this chemical. And that's really, and I'll end on this, what our whole case is if you're going to put something in somebody's drinking water, and that something has a toxic effect, you should at least tell people so that they can make the decision on their own accord to drink that water or not. And the people of Parkersburg, West Virginia, will never give them that choice.
Right. I feel pretty strongly that they shouldn't even do that. Yeah. But I appreciate it, Chris. Yeah. Really, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, we have one more guest here. Joining me now is Michael Baum. Michael, where do you practice out of?
Los Angeles.
Okay, and you are working on a case. I mean, this seems insane to me. A drug tainted with AIDS. Is that my understanding?
That was the litigation. That litigation is, for the most part, done.
Okay.
But we did litigate that. What happened was that they were collecting plasma to make products that had the coagulating proteins that hemophiliacs needed in the products. And in order to get those coagulating proteins, they would obtain plasma from live people, they were plasma donors, and if any of those people had HIV, it would be transmitted over.
Oh, jeez. And so what are you working on now?
What, with respect to that?
Or just any case is there something specific that you're working on now that you wanted to discuss, or... Oh, it's factor eight.
Factor eight.
Yes, okay. Let's talk about factor eight. Okay. What is factor eight?
Factor eight is a coagulating protein that's necessary for people to not bleed if they get injured. It can be obtained and made into a product that hemophiliacs can inject to prevent bleeds.
And so people donate their blood, and that's where the basis of factor eight comes from?
Yes. What happens is that it's a mass-produced product. It was a very clever product that they would take thousands of donations of plasma, or that they would purchase from either prisoners or in plasma centers down in seedy sections of town. And they would put all these thousands of units of plasma into big vats and process them into different blood products, and some of them were used for just creating volume when people had blood loss, red blood cells, and amongst the products they would make were coagulating proteins for hemophiliacs, and that was called factor 8 and factor 9. And what they had, if you imagine what like your turkey gravy looks like, or when you put it in the refrigerator, you'll see different layers of
right,
things.
Right, right, right. There's separation between different liquids that have different densities.
Right. And each of those can become a separate product.
Okay.
And one of the products was antibody products and hepatitis B immune globulin. That's the antibodies for hepatitis B was a very hot product at the time. And so the companies that were making these products to get the factor VIII were also making hepatitis B immune globulins and general immune globulins out of the same products. And in order to do that, you had to have donors who had those antibodies. In order to have donors that had those antibodies, you had to have people who were exposed to those diseases because their bodies would then create those antibodies. And they even got to the point where they would inject vaccines of diseases in prisoners in order to get them to generate antibodies, and then they would harvest them essentially to make these immune globulin products. And
did the prisoners? Wait, this is sort of a side note, but were the prisoners aware of this whole process?
Yeah.
Okay. So they would sell it.
Yeah. They would sell their blood and the plasma, like Angola.
Okay.
Had a plasma farm basically, and the guys would get in line to go donate plasma in order to buy cigarettes and stuff like that. The problem was is that they wanted to harvest hepatitis B antibodies, and they wanted to get the factor VIII proteins. And the hepatitis B immune globulins, hepatitis B epidemic was occurring amongst promiscuous gay males and prisoners because they would have, it's a bloodborne disease, and it was commonly transmitted by rectal intercourse. And so in the promiscuous gay male populations in urban populations like New York and San Francisco and Los Angeles, there was a hepatitis B epidemic. And so the manufacturer set up plasma centers in gay sections of town, like West Hollywood and L.A., and buy plasma from them. They would put ads in magazines saying, hey, we need your plasma to make hepatitis B immune globulin products and help people who are exposed to burns and burn units. And they had a lot of good products that they could make from it. But they were supposed to be using what's called normal healthy donors. And they were not supposed to be taking people who actually had active hepatitis B. And so, but they sort of disregarded that with respect to getting these hepatitis B antibodies.
Yeah.
Because the product was, they were mass producing so many products out of the vats that they got, they could spread the cost of manufacturing and acquiring all that plasma out amongst all these products and make a lot of money off of the different products.
So in other words, the value of having someone infected with hepatitis was for a specific antibody.
Yeah.
However, and you weren't supposed to use that for another drug. However, you've got the blood there. It's sitting there in the vat. And one of the byproducts is this other antibody. However, it doesn't meet the standards that you would for that other drug, right? Like so
that's generally correct.
So, okay. So I'm just trying to get the dynamic. I mean, I guess like it's sort of the same thing they do with like bourbon or something, right? Like they take the top layer, becomes this grade of bourbon, and the bottom layer or maple syrup. The amber is from the top. The B is from the bottom. And there may be different standards as to where the amber can come from and the B can come from. They ignored that and took it from the same source because it was just cheaper.
Generally speaking, that's more or less correct. What happened is that the coagulating proteins that were used to make factor VIII came off the top.
Okay.
And it didn't go through a viral deactivation step. The rest of the, it's called fractionating, like taking off fractions of the plasma, went through alcohol processing that basically stripped the lipid coats off of viruses. And so the products lower down the process had a viral deactivation step. but the step that was done for making hemophilia products didn't go through that process. So any viruses that were in those vats of plasma, that were in that top layer of stuff that, that was pulled out to make the coagulating proteins, would get transmitted to hemophiliacs.
And did they know this? Who was the company that was involved in this? And it, in my understanding is they shipped it overseas knowingly?
Eventually, yes.
Okay. Tell us that part of the story, because this is another example of like one of those things where it's like, you can't believe human beings would do this.
What happened was that in about 1982, they started noticing that hemophiliacs were coming down with a disease similar to a disease that was prevalent in the gay community. And they hadn't called it AIDS yet. Okay. It was a gay-related immune deficiency. And then they started investigating. And they found that there was a connection in that they were, and they had these, we had these memos that showed that, you know, there's a disease that's showing up in hemophiliacs. It's the same thing as it's in, that's showing up in these gay populations. We have plasma centers in those gay population centers, and it may be a bloodborne disease that's coming over. And so they secretly decided and had meetings with the FDA and amongst themselves. There's four manufacturers, Bayer, Alpha, Baxter, and Armour, Rhone, Palonk. It's gone through so many different changes now, but I can't remember what the name of the Sanofi, I think, is who owns them now. And they all said, well, we've been using this plasma in gay centers and from prisons to get the hepatitis B antibodies to make hepatitis B immune globulins. And we just are using some of that plasma to make some of the products for hemophiliacs. And they sort of said, well, we maybe need to quietly stop doing that. And they requested that it not be a written order, that they would do it voluntarily and they would quietly do it.
So they go to the FDA and they say, look, we may have a problem here. We've been doing something that we shouldn't.
No, the FDA came to them and said, we think you've got a problem. You need to knock it off. And then they talked. They had a pretty cozy relationship with the FDA guys.
And so they respond, we'll do it, but you can't announce it because we don't want this to.
Right.
We don't want to scare our shareholders. We don't want to scare the public. We want to maintain our good image, even though we weren't supposed to be doing this exactly anyways in the first place. Is that it?
That's correct.
Okay. So then what happens?
So they started trying to figure out ways to either screen out donors that would be likely to be HIV positive by that time, and because they determined it was a virus. And they started doing heat treating systems. And in 1983, Baxter had a heat treating system that you could heat the plasma while it was before it got processed into powder, and it would deactivate the virus, deactivate many viruses, and like hepatitis. And so that product started getting manufactured and get licensed in the U.S., but they still had warehouses full of frozen plasma that had not been screened as tightly and was not used to make the heat-treated product. And they had non-heat-treated product that was basically processed into a paste and was ready to be freeze-dried and shipped, and they had not properly screened plasma sitting in warehouses. And they decided to keep selling it. And one of their rationales was that hemophilia is a dangerous disease, and you don't know how long this AIDS disease is going to take into effect and maybe cause deaths. It may be a long-term thing. It may a bleed for a hemophiliac in the head or in the stomach can be, you know, fatal.
So they justified, like, so in other words, they say, we have such a strong reason to believe that the product we're selling is not safe that we are going to agree to stop producing it, essentially, in the way that we've been producing it. However, and they don't tell the FDA this, we got a whole warehouse full of these defective products, and we have made the determination, for the sake of our customers, that they should have these defective products because they need it so badly.
Yes.
It was very sweet of them, but they ended up infecting how many people?
About 10,000 in the U.S. and maybe another 10,000 internationally.
And this happened
during the 80s.
Wow. And so did anybody go to jail for these decisions? Was there any type of compensation? What was the outcome?
All right, so nobody went to jail in the U.S. Japan, France, and it might have been Ireland all had health ministers who were had criminal actions taken against them, and they went to jail.
The health ministers went to jail.
Yeah, like in France, the health minister went to jail. It would have been the equivalent here of a guy like Harry Meyer, who was the head of the Bureau of Biologics in the U.S.
Why wouldn't the company officials go to jail?
Well, that's a good question. So there's an inquiry done in Canada and Japan. They had a company official in Japan was jailed, but nothing happened to anyone here in the U.S. There were lawsuits brought here in the U.S. There was a big Papp was in. A lot of lawyers were involved with those cases, and they had about 6,000 hemophiliacs here in the U.S. Got about $100,000 apiece.
Wow.
And then, I litigated cases independently of that. They had not found the advertisements in the gay magazines and did not take depositions of the prisoners, like in Angola, to find out how this plasma was actually being collected. And so I went forward with the cases, and then while I was doing that, I found that they were, when in the U.S. they had just determined not to continue to use the unheat-treated material, they started finding markets for it in Asia. And I had some of those documents delivered to me while I was working on the U.S. cases that showed that they were sending it out to Asia because they had the rationale was they're used to hepatitis. They're used to blood-borne diseases like hepatitis. They won't be freaked out about HIV. So we can sell it there. So they sold it there until like late 85, early 86. While they still had the heat-treated product here in the U.S. And that we had these gruesome emails.
It's just unbelievable.
Where there were telexes then, the gruesome memos, where there's a guy from Hong Kong, a doctor from Hong Kong, saying, hey, I hear you've got a heat-treated product there in the U.S. that deactivates the HIV virus. We would like to get some of that here.
Yeah, we'd like the good stuff that's not tainted.
And the response was from Bayer's Qatar division, there's not a lot of that product available right now. You've got a long-term contract for the unheat-treated product.
Oh,
you need to finish using up your stores of that before we'll give you any heat-treated product. And besides, the non-heat-treated product was they said it wasn't hazardous. It's the same fine product we've always provided you. It's gone through really good screening.
When you get a guy like that, do you get a guy like that to sit on the stand? I'm just curious. When you find these type of documents, do you ever find the author of these documents and just sort of say like, what in the world could you have been thinking?
So one of them was a guy named Hink. And by the time we got to him, which was AIDS litigation, a lot of this was just unknown until the 90s, mid-90s and late 90s and early 2000. And so some of those guys were old. And by the time we got to one of them, for instance, had Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't much you could do with him. Some of them did have their depositions taken, and there was a lot of litigation that Mike Papadopoulou was actually involved with, and quite a bit of good documentation came out the best stuff came out after we found the gay ads and did the actually interviewed prisoners. But the thing that was kind of grotesque with respect to the prisoner operations was that the prisoners themselves would run the programs, and they had set up relationships with some of their fellow prisoners to have rectal intercourse while they were waiting to donate their plasma. They had the plasma center had bathroom stalls that they could go into, and they would use that as a way of meeting their boyfriends to have sex while they were waiting in line to donate the plasma. And that was a way of having the disease transmit and spread.
On purpose?
No, they weren't doing that. They were just enjoying themselves.
Oh, okay.
Right.
They would make it.
They would do other things, though, on purpose. They were supposed to not be hepatitis B positive. And if they knew they were, they would line themselves up in line and have a guy they knew wasn't hepatitis B positive get his blood drawn for testing, and then they'd switch the line out for the guy that was positive, and they would send the plasma for the non-positive guy up under the name of the guy who was positive, and it would go up. And they can't. It was pretty
unregulated.
Unregulated, unsupervised, and fairly grotesque.
Unbelievable.
So we ended up trying to bring suits for the people in the foreign countries. And the judge here in the U.S., it was Judge Grady in Chicago, Eastern District, ruled that the cases were too inconvenient for the local manufacturers who had their headquarters, like, in Chicago, to litigate in Chicago. It was more convenient to litigate them in Taiwan or Hong Kong or Israel or Italy or France. They did a forum non-convenience motion, and they all got scattered all over the world. And then they got subjected to laws in other countries that were not as positive for statute of limitations purposes, for instance. Or you know what a statute of repose is? Like, it's just if a product is made in 1980 and you get 10 years to find out that it's defective.
Right.
Well, if you don't, here you may not discover that it's defective, and the statute of limitations runs from the date of discovery. In those countries, if you don't find out in time, too bad, you lose. But they still got some money. Like the Taiwanese got $60,000.
Crazy. Well, Michael Baum, thank you for relating the story to us.
I'd like to tell you where you can get some information.
Yes.
I put a lot of these documents, I got them out from under seal, and they're available.
Tell me where they are, and we will put them on the blog at majority.fm.
Okay, so at my website at baumhedlundlaw.com.
Hedlund is H-E...
BAUMHEDLUND.com.
Uh-huh.
Just do a search in the search for hemophilia, and there's a pretty good essay that we wrote that has links to all these incredible documents that we acquired.
Exhibit 6, the litigation.
And there's also a good warehouse of documents at the University of San Francisco. They have a project to take documents that have been de-designated from litigation as confidential, and they've created a website and a database that
you can
journalists search. Or academics can go to get documents from all sorts of litigation. So one of the things we do when we get the litigation completed, we try to get documents out from under seal and then send them up there. And there's a lot of lawyers have been doing that. And those documents are there. It's at DIDA at the University of San Francisco.
DIDA?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great.
So there's not just for the hemophilia project, but for
all of these cases.
Antidepressant, suicide, withdrawal, Neurontin, Zyprexa. A lot of these litigations have gotten documents out from under seal, and they are now online.
This is the drug industry document archive.
Yeah. It's a great resource for guys like you and investigators and academics to be able to research what actually happened.
All right. Well, we will put that up also on our blog at majority.fm. Michael Baum, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate
it. You're welcome. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somewhere I lost my drive, between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. The months shifted into years, while I shifted in.